This is UN and Africa from the United Nations in New York. I'm Matthew Wells. In this week's programme, it's simply too early to declare an end to intercommunal conflict in Darfur, despite a lull in fighting. And African countries are losing out on vital tax revenue from profiteering multinational companies. But first, the South Sudanese government has given the go-ahead for the deployment of a 4,000-strong regional protection force recently mandated by the UN Security Council. The announcement came on the 4th of September while council members were in the country to meet with President Salva Kiir and other politicians and see for themselves the conditions facing internally displaced civilians in UN protection camps. Daniel Dickinson has more details.
Civil conflict has raged in South Sudan since December 2013. Hundreds of people have been killed, over 700,000 have fled across borders as refugees, and over 1.5 million are displaced inside the country. It's hoped the 4,000 troops of the Security Council-mandated Regional Protection Force will provide the stability to allow some people to return home. Martin Elia Lomuro, Cabinet Affairs Minister in the Transitional Government of National Unity, read a joint communique after the Council delegation met President Kiir.
The United Nations Security Council and the Transitional Government of National Unity agreed to work in a fresh spirit of cooperation to advance the interests of South Sudanese people, particularly their aspirations for justice, liberty, and prosperity.
South Sudan had initially held back on agreeing to the force, saying it was a violation of sovereignty. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
And staying in South Sudan, the international community may have failed to broker a lasting peace so far, but it's not prepared to give up. That's the passionate view of former Botswanan President Festus Mogae, who is chairperson of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission for South Sudan, or JMEC. JMEC is made up of key stakeholders, African member states and the African Union, to monitor the implementation of last year's peace agreement. Gabriel Shadar asked Mr. Mogae why intercommunal violence was continuing with such devastating consequences for civilians in areas of South Sudan, including the Upper Nile and Equatorial states.
The current fighting in Equatoria is not necessarily related to the fighting between the government and IO. The Equatorians have grievances of their own regarding their land, regarding various violations of the, if they consider their own rights as citizens. Yes, there is continuing fighting in a number of areas, but we here, sitting here, cannot say for certain the extent of the fighting. The authorities, although they are impatient with us for saying that, have never allowed the citizen to do its job of going out there freely and inspecting and verifying.
Now it's time I ask you to give a message to the people of South Sudan.
I want to say to the people of South Sudan that, as evidenced by the visit of the Security Council of the United Nations, the international community are determined to bring peace to South Sudan. The international community are a partner with the people and government and all the people of South Sudan and all the political parties. Everybody is anxious for this country to find peace so that it can begin to address the normal challenges of development of a developing country, which they are. And that therefore, that is why we fail, but we don't give up. The international community is not prepared to give up because they are convinced that peace can be brought about. You have lived together sometime in the past. You can do it again. It is within the competence of the leaders of South Sudan to agree to work together, to compromise. Compromise means give and take. And unfortunately, the leadership in the country have not shown enough of that flexibility to date. But we hope they will.
It's too early to declare an end to intercommunal conflicts in Sudan's troubled Darfur region. That's the view of Mike Zakuma, the officer in charge of civil affairs for the Joint African Union UN mission in Darfur, UNAMID. Along with continuing tensions and clashes between government forces and armed groups, intercommunal violence and criminality has been a major problem for civilians and peacekeepers. UNAMID has recently come up with a new strategy to address the violence, which prioritises working closely with state authorities on its root causes. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir declared on Wednesday that peace had returned to the region, saying that the government had met its commitments, according to news reports. Seti Obudi asked Mr. Tsakuma whether a recent decrease in attacks marked the beginning of a peaceful coexistence.
For as long as we have less clashes, less fatalities, less displacements, I think we're witnessing some improvements in the situation in Darfur. But no, in the sense that the peace and quiet we are enjoying, I would say, is very ephemeral. It is superficial and cannot be sustained unless we put in place measures to address the root cause of the conflict in Darfur. So I would say it is too early to conclude that Darfur is peaceful. We cannot be complacent.
Can you tell us, sir, what are the root causes of the conflict?
There are so many. But before I go into that, let me just say that as foreigners, we do not pretend to understand completely the causes of the conflict in Darfur. We depend on information from our national counterparts, from the victims and our local stakeholders. Now, having said that, I'll tell you briefly what we've been told or what we see as some of the causes of the conflict. Mostly, they have to do with competition over natural resources. The farmers, who are sedentary farmers who cultivate the soil, compete with the nomadic communities, who actually are animal keepers, over scarce water resources and fodder and pasture. We also have competition, fight over land title. The competition over land has a long history, but bottom line, it is one main cause of the conflict in Darfur.
African countries are losing out on significant tax revenues from multinational companies, despite the huge profits those companies are making. That's according to the Deputy Director General of the European Commission's International Cooperation and Development Directorate. Klaus Rüdeshauser was recently at the International Monetary Fund, IMF, in Washington, D.C. Many of the countries whose raw materials are being exploited by multinationals are powerless to do anything about it, as Mr. Rüdeshauser explained to Mark Betancourt.
There are pretty extreme cases. There are countries in Africa where big multinationals exploit raw materials to the tune of billions per year. And then to that country, they pay a couple of $100,000 as taxes. So you can see that the gap is enormous.
Tell me more about the fact that these have to do with actual international tax policies and not something that countries can necessarily deal with on the domestic level.
That's right. Because of the way both national but mainly the international tax system is structured, companies can make huge profits, but the actual country where these profits are made benefits to a very, very small degree from that activity. We cannot obviously expect a single developing country to be able to tax international corporations, because if the tax legislation, the tax rules are not so that that company is actually required to pay taxes where they make the profit or even to disclose where they have activity and where they make profit, then it's impossible for a single developing country to actually even go and raise taxes, and the company will just say, sorry, we declare our profits, but not in your country. So that's why there is a real challenge also for the international tax system to be reformed. And this is not the claim by NGOs. This is recognized by the UN, by the OECD, by the IMF. But it still requires to be done. And where I would like to make a point is that the European Union is firmly committed to actually do it and to actually bring about these changes. Obviously, it requires that all other partners, all other countries also play ball. But we are very strongly engaged to make sure that will happen. And this will not happen overnight either. But I think that at least a very clear commitment from the European side is there to do it.
What are the things that are required that aren't being done now to bring that international tax policy into reign?
Well, countries or groups of countries, as it were, need to adopt appropriate legislation. In fact, the U.S. have been one of the first to adopt such legislation with the Dodd-Frank Act. The only problem is it's currently not yet in force for various reasons, but still the U.S. have been first. We have followed with the first piece of legislation, and we're actually right now in the process of adopting more legislation in the same direction.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of UN and Africa. You can follow more of our programmes at radio.un.org. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Matthew Wells.